Live from Burbank, California, the land of SUVs and fat people, it's the Mark Maron Show. And now, environment and schmirement, Mark Maron.
Hey, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, sulking conservatives, walking with their faces turned down because they're so ashamed that they are now trying to exploit something as ridiculous as a Spanish national anthem for political points. Come on, really? Senator Lamar Alexander from Tennessee introduced a bill mandating that the national anthem be sung in English, saying that the national anthem in Spanish is undercutting national unity. What is he, stupid? This is jingoistic crap. This is a plan to divide and conquer over nothing. The national anthem should be in every language so everyone who lives here can understand it properly. Does he want to mandate something that says you can't do the national anthem on drugs? I guess people had a problem when Hendrix did it, didn't he? The Star Spangled Banner, I'm sure they got pissed off. But, you know, it was a tribute. Man, I'd rather hear that thing than hear it sung at a baseball game by some whoever. I mean, look, I believe that the song is the nature of this country, is the democratic process, the idea of democracy, the idea of people from around the world. Granted, they should learn the language, but it might inspire them to learn the language if they put the national anthem in their language and they understood what the words meant. For themselves. I mean, some things don't translate the same way. Some words in Spanish have deeper meaning than what they're mean in English. And if somebody can connect to this in the Spanish language and it gives them a sense of what this country is and a sense of national pride, so be it. I think they should have that opportunity. No one's saying change the damn song. I can't believe they're trying to get political points off of this thing. Because it's just divide and conquer, jingoistic race baiting in a way. It's politics by division. It's some sort of Rovian plan. It's got nothing to do with immigration. It's crap. It's a stupid distraction from what really needs to be done, which is create some immigration policy that makes sense. We got a big show today. Greg Dooley, from the Twilight Singers, formerly from the Afghan Whigs, has a new record out, and he spent a lot of time in New Orleans recording this record right after Katrina. Some interesting stories about why that city drives him. Joseph Masco, the author of The Nuclear Borderlands, The Manhattan Project, and Post-Cold War New Mexico. Lofty book, but hopefully he'll be able to take us to explore a little the repercussions of testing these damn bunker-busting missiles in Nevada at the beginning of June. These tests have not been done in years, and they're going to start blowing up atomic weapons in order to prepare for nuking Iraq or Iran. And I want to talk to Joseph Masco about, you know, what happened in New Mexico. What do we have to look for in terms of repercussions of this? The dialogue has to once again be opened about nuclear testing, nuclear proliferation, and what is going on. And he talks about my home state, which apparently is a radioactive junkyard. Jack Boulware, my buddy from San Francisco, the On the Fringe travel writer, has for some reason done a big piece on pirates for Southwest Magazine. He talked to the guy at the Pirate Museum in Key West, Florida. So let's get the lowdown on pirates. Apparently the article is supposed to come out alongside of Pirates of the Caribbean, and the depiction may not be what we would think, what real pirates really are. And then Lieutenant Ronnie Randolph, an Army recruiter. You know, these guys are they're predators. And they have ways of working, tactics, strategies that are very disturbing. And I think it's important that we have him on because I'd like to know what those tactics are. And I'd like to take him to task for it, for preying on the kids and sending them into a situation that it doesn't provide them with what they say that they do. We'll talk to him in a little while. But you know, first, a lot happened in the news today. We don't want you to be caught off guard or uninformed. So here's tonight's edition of the Mark Maron Show Short Order News. Iran threatened today to attack Israel in response to any, quote, evil, unquote, act by the United States. Did you think the first day of Armageddon would be a Tuesday? Isn't that weird? Because I always thought it would be a Friday.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Under trial for fraud and conspiracy, former Enron CEO Ken Lay testified how he sold $70 million in Enron shares back to the company to pay for personal luxuries. Lay insisted he was forced to sell the $70 million in Enron stock to repay funds he'd borrowed to buy other securities, not because he knew the company was in trouble. He then tried to appeal to the jury by adding, quote, "You know what it's like when you got to sell $70 million in stock? Come on, we've all been there, right?" Unquote. Iran threatened, did I already do that? I did, didn't I? Someone who ate dinner at TGI Fridays found a piece of human flesh on his hamburger shortly after a restaurant worker accidentally cut his finger. Despite bad publicity from the incident, TGI Fridays is confident they will remain the most fashionable eating spot in Bloomington, Indiana. And that's the short order news for tonight. You know, folks, yesterday we talked to Jim's brother, John. Is it John?
Yeah, John.
The activist, grassroots organizer, union dude, about the protest yesterday. He was out at the protest. We talked to him. It was very compelling. And we also called our buddy Jeff DiCarlo, the tax lawyer, tax accountant, BioWave analyst, who was also an activist, also out protesting. If you didn't get to hear it yesterday, here's a snippet of Jeff DiCarlo talking about his protest during the immigration rallies yesterday. Now, have you been out at all? Have you done anything? Did you at least go out and take a walk outside to see if there's any protests going on or anything?
Well, you know, I did. I have been affected by this protest also. You know, I'm a participant victim. I went to get a burrito at my local shop, and that was closed. And, you know, that's part of my routine. That's part of my day. That threw me off. I wasn't able to do that.
But did you feel proud of your brothers, though, out there, you know, saying, you know, shutting down work, you know, to go out and protest by not making the burritos for you?
Sure. Yeah.
All right. Okay, Jeff. So you're going to be in bed the whole week. Maybe we should check back with you in a couple of days to see how your protest is going, what effect it's having.
That would be great. If you could send somebody over with some pizza or something like that, that would be great. I am not leaving the house.
All right, I'll make sure the world knows, and I thank you for being sort of an impromptu correspondent who helped us out today.
Absolutely. Hey, and I don't know if you guys have any kind of compensation or anything like that, but you know, I could use a ride to I have to go visit my mom this weekend.
Where does she live, Jeff?
She lives just in San Diego.
All right, we'll try and work that out. We'll try and get you pizza and maybe Jim's brother or somebody.
Wait a minute. You're laying in bed all week, and you're eating pizza in bed, and you want us to give you a free ride to San Diego?
Well, I think it's important. I would rather be eating a burrito, but I'm not able to do that because of this movement that's taking place.
So out of honoring for the movement, you're going to eat pizza and have someone drive you to San Diego.
Sure, that's a good way to say it, yeah.
All right, Jeff, thanks a lot. You have a good day relaxing.
Okay, fight the good fight.
Yeah, I will, man. Okay, that was Jeff DiCarlo yesterday. He obviously is continuing his protests, continuing his support for immigration rights at home for the week, and we've got him back on the horn here. Jeff DiCarlo, tax accountant, activist, BioWave analyst. Are you continuing your protest as we speak?
I am, Mark, and it's not easy.
Yeah.
I made this commitment, and I'm developing some bed sores, but I feel it's the very least I could do.
Well, I think it's important that you're raising political activism to this level. So how's the protest going today? Have you been outside?
Absolutely not. No, you know, I mean, and it was hard. It was hard. I got a neighbor to go get me a burrito, and thankfully the burrito shop down the street from me is open again. So that part of my day is still in place, but you know, I got out to the stoop.
So now, in taking this type of political action, you know, I guess you feel on some level that when you buy a burrito, do you feel like you're supporting your Mexican brothers or?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what's the plan for the week, Jeff?
Well, you know, it's more of the same,
more
of passive resistance.
Mm-hmm.
I have, you know, I've stopped paying my cable bill in protest.
Mm-hmm.
That's off. And I, you know, I'm just catching up on playing with my cats because I've been kind of neglecting them. And really just kind of reflecting. You know?
Okay, good. So you're fighting the fight, man. I appreciate that. Well, thanks for letting us check back in with you. We'll try to keep abreast of your protest because, you know, it's important that there are guys like you out there doing this.
Yeah, you know, Mark, while I have you here, I want to let your listeners know about a medicinal mushroom movement that I'm trying to get started.
Okay.
Where I'm trying to put it on the ballot for medicinal mushrooms, psychedelic mushrooms, to help alleviate boredom the effects of glaucoma.
Okay, Jeff, we're running out of time. We got to go. We'll check back in with you tomorrow.
Okay. Hey, you guys have anybody? Like, I just need some money for some inner tubes for my bike.
Yeah. We'll take care of that, Jeff. Thanks, man.
Okay.
We'll talk.
All right. Power of the people.
Yeah. Right on, man. We'll talk to you later. Thanks, Jeff DeCarlo. We'll be back in a. Just, I don't know if that's, you know what I mean? I guess he's doing something. We'll be back with Greg Dooley from the Twilight Singer. Stay with us.
And now he's not focused on the polls. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. That song, that sound that you hear, the Twilight Singers. Surviving rock and roll, my friends, is no small task. To survive and be prolific is amazing. Greg Dooley has recorded 11 albums in his career. Is that about right? 11?
That's right, yeah.
7 with the Afghan Whigs and 4 with the Twilight Singers. The latest album, Powder Burns, is a very personal album that reflects on not only a difficult time in Greg's life, but also the life of the city of New Orleans, where Greg recorded the record. The album, the CD, I don't know how one says it now. He started it there before Katrina hit and went back right after the storm, drowned the city, and finished the album during curfews, power outages, and the chaos that was and is New Orleans post-Katrina. Welcome to the show, Greg Dooley.
Hi, Mark.
Nice of you to come down.
My pleasure.
So you've recorded in New Orleans before. You've been there many times. You have a relationship with that city.
I lived in the city for 2.5 years, and I keep a residence down there that I'd spend like 4 months a year, every year since
really?
Then. Yeah.
And was that residence affected by a Katrina? Were you in one of those? I was just down there doing a benefit, and before I went down there, I really, no one could have any idea what the hell happened down there until you go down there.
No, until you see it in a 360-degree view, it's just something on television. When you see it and smell it and hear it.
Man.
When I flew back in after the hurricane, I got in, I think, like October 2nd. So it was just like 33 days old, something like that.
And you had begun recording there, and you chose to go back because you thought it was important to be part of the city during that time.
Yeah, I think, New Orleans has been a good friend to me.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just hang out with your friends when in the good times, you're not really a true friend, I don't think. I think that city needed life in it, and it was a ghost town in a very difficult time. A bunch of my friends lost their homes, and I was there to help them as much as record the record.
And you didn't, your home didn't, your place didn't get nailed?
No, I mean, if you look at a map of New Orleans after the Civil War, what the city was then is the way it's supposed to be built. It's on the high ground, wrapped around the natural levee that is the river. And the city began to expand, that's when it started to go into the swamplands and the lower lying areas, and those were always vulnerable.
Right. I found that when I was there, it was interesting that the locals kept talking about the areas that were unaffected as the Isle of Denial.
Mm-hmm.
And, you just go right out, 2 minutes outside the city, and it was like Armageddon had happened.
Yeah.
And it's still like that. And I was just there like a few weeks ago. So now, how did this... inform or take what effect did it have on the recording, on you and on the record itself?
It's New Orleans is the most artistically inspirational place for me. I mean, I started recording the first time there probably 9 years ago, and have gone back for every record since. There's something in the air there. When I was there before the hurricane, I left 2 weeks before the hurricane. There was a tropical storm called Cindy that happened, and that's just below a Category 1. So mm-hmm. that was a little hint of what was to come. When I got back, I had never experienced martial law or curfew before.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a bit strange, and there was uneducated and ignorant people in charge of in authoritative positions. The National Guard, they had checkpoints set up. There wasn't a lot of people down there to check. So if I'm riding my bike at 1:30 in the morning and the curfew's at 2, and I get stopped by a teenager who asks to see my identification, I asked him for probable cause.
Uh-huh.
And he said, there's a curfew. And I said, that curfew... doesn't happen for another half an hour, so you got to tell me why you're stopping me.
A teenager?
A teenager. And when I persisted with, why do you want my driver's license? Finally, his comrade came over and said, let him go, Dan. He's being a dick. And so so they called me a dick and they let me go. And that's who was in charge down there.
They were just kids? They were just doing it out of were they assigned?
No, they were
National Guard.
Yeah.
He's being a dick. That's amazing. So which songs, are there songs on the album that are directly about New Orleans?
The final song, it's called I Wish I Was, and it is my love song to New Orleans.
Oh, that's me. And some of the other stuff on there. Now you've gone through a period yourself of reevaluation, and you've made it through some demonic periods, I imagine. Mm-hmm. Is there a lot of that on the record as well?
Yeah, I think that after I got back down to New Orleans after the hurricane, I realized that there was probably a parallel between my life and what happened to New Orleans, mm-hmm. Destruction and rebirth. So mm-hmm. I began to merge the experiences on the
Well, that's song. Cool. I mean, I think the album sounds great. I really dug it. And it's called Powder Burns, is it not?
Yes.
And you had some guests on there. Who were some of the people that joined you on that record?
Joseph Arthur, uh-huh. who is a fantastic singer-songwriter, sings on three of the songs. Ani DeFranco sings on three of the songs. My ex-Afghan Whig bandmate, John Curley, plays bass on one of the songs. So.
Well, that's cool. And you guys are going on tour. Where are you heading first?
Playing Minneapolis on the 18th of May.
That's a good rock and roll town.
It is.
It's a great city. And great then you're going to head out around the country?
Yeah, then Chicago, and then we'll wrap all the way around the country.
All right, Greg Dooley. The CD is called Powder Burns. It's the Twilight Singers. There's a link to him on markmaron.com. You can just hit his name, and it will go there, and you will see everywhere they're going to be, and all the albums are available there through his entire career. It's quite a catalog. Thanks for joining us, man.
Thank you, Mark.
Fear the phone, not the doorknob. Mark Maron.
You read that too, huh?
Yeah.
Doorknobs,
yeah.
Elevator buttons, not a problem. The phone, just teeming with the bacterial onslaught. Armies, SWAT teams of germs.
I can understand why, too.
Ready to jump on your face and crawl up your nose and into your eyes and up down your throat. Just armies of germs. Just ready to go. Mm-hmm. Scary, right? Is that anyone's phone? Or is it, is it a payphone thing? Or is it the home phone? I mean, usually, the office
somebody
phone.
Somebody else's phone besides yours.
Yours has your germs on it, so that's friendly to you.
I would think so, but, you should probably spray, like, Lysol into every orifice.
And be one of those people?
Electrical orifice.
Be one of those people?
Yes.
Spraying things?
We got to do it, man. I already bought a bunch of face masks for the oncoming bird flu thing.
Oh, I didn't even start washing my hands until I was an adult, after I went to the bathroom. How's that grab you? Huh? I wasn't taught that. I thought it was just a hearsay thing, like an old wives' tale.
Your dad's a doctor. He didn't teach you to wash your hands?
Maybe he did, but maybe I just didn't think it was that important. It was one of those stupid things you fight against, for no reason, like flossing. Why fight flossing? I fought mm-hmm. flossing. When I was a kid, you should floss. I'm like, it's just like too much trouble. Now I floss compulsively, and I wash my hands twice, before and after. And I'm going to start spraying the things with the anti. But I don't use that hand desanitizer. I don't use that. You know why?
Why?
Because I hear it kills the good bacteria too and dry out your skin.
I heard that too, but I still use it.
You use the portable hand sanitizer?
Yeah,
stuff?
Hell, man, when you go someplace like a airline restroom or something, I'm swallowing that stuff.
Really? Well, what do you do in the restroom that makes you that frightened? What, are you rubbing your face on the floor?
When was the last time you traveled?
I travel a lot.
You go into one of those airline restrooms.
You mean on the airplane?
All hell breaks loose in there for some reason.
On the airplane. Maybe you're doing it wrong.
No, I'm not talking about me.
Oh.
I'm talking about, in general, people, other people besides me. They are dirty. I completely flush myself out before I go onto an airplane.
On the airplane, by the end of the flight, they get pretty nasty. You're absolutely right.
Oh, man, right in the beginning, too, because as soon as you get on that plane, there's a whole line of people just going, and you're, you know, to get into that restroom for some reason.
You know what's worse? Is if you're sitting in the back of the plane and you got to deal with that.
Yeah.
The smell of the air.
Oh.
But you know, it's weird though. You want to hear some personal weird thing I have?
Well, why not?
I think that when you look at yourself in the mirror of an airline bathroom,
mm-hmm.
that is the most honest depiction of you. I don't even know why I think that. There's something about being suspended in the air in between places. It's a poetic thing, I think. But I always find that, like, whenever I'm in an airline bathroom, I always take a good long look at myself. Because you're not at any place. You're moving through the air. It's poetry, man. I'm not expecting you to understand it.
There's usually fear on your face, too.
Right? I'm not afraid on airplanes anymore. I can't afford it. I don't have the time. Don't have the energy. I used to be paralyzed with fear every time I travel. Back when I used to do drugs, it was unbelievable what I would do just to prepare for a flight. I'd stay up all night. I'd smoke bong load after bong load of reefer. I'd take pills. I didn't care, just so I could sleep maybe an hour. And the sad thing is, even if I'd stay up for 2 days, you know, doing whatever I'm doing to stay up, I'd only sleep an hour, and then I'd just spend the rest of the hour all hungover and sweaty and in fear on top of it. It was a complete waste of time. You know what cured my fear of flying?
No, what?
There's nothing you can do. Nothing. I mean, I know if you go see United 92, then you might have, but even that didn't end well. But I mean, there's nothing you can do to if something goes wrong. I was one of those people, Jim, where I would literally. There was one time I became this guy. I'm sitting there. I'm looking out the window of the plane, and I see the engine, and there's like a little stream of oil, kind of like coming by.
Is, yeah.
I didn't know that. All right, so I go to the. I became that guy where I'm talking to my wife. It was my first wife at the time. I'm like, there's trouble. That engine's in trouble. There's stuff coming out of it. There's trouble. And she's like, there's not trouble. I'm like, look, do you see oil coming? I'm going to take care of this. So I became the guy with the panic face who went to the front of the plane and went up to the flight attendant and said, yeah, I just, you know, try to keep cool, okay? But
there's a nut on board.
Yeah. but there's oil coming out of that engine over there. And he looked at me in retrospect with the look that he has prepared for people like me and just said, sir, please return to your seat and I'll tell the captain about it. But it's completely normal, I think. And he did that, and he said it was completely, whatever. Yeah,
I got a panic once when I saw William Shatner on the wing.
Yeah, well, that is panic because that would mean that you're picking up, you know, old episodes of Twilight Zone in your head.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is scary. Was he dressed in the little demon outfit? Yeah. That was a good episode.
Oh,
dude,
yeah.
So let's do this. Every week we reflect in our times of sorrow as we look back on the lives of the recently departed. Here now is grief correspondent Mort Mortensen with our weekly remembrance.
Oh, hey. Thanks, Jim, for giving me your seat.
That was nice. He's going to go out there and
smoke or something.
Jim doesn't smoke.
Charles Zocharides. Charles Zocharides, the psychiatrist who said gays could become straight. Dr. Charles W. Zocharides, a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst who spent his career proclaiming that homosexuality was a curable neurosis, has died of heart failure, apparently after realizing his favorite part in Ben-Hur between Charlton Heston and Stephen Boyd is probably the gayest scene anyone ever put in a movie.
Yeah. You all right?
Cats. In the 1960s, Zocharides' views that gays suffered from a treatable mental illness brought international notoriety, mostly in the form of withering sarcasm and flamboyantly obscene gesturing. Yeah, a lot of people were PO'd at that.
Yeah, it was upsetting.
Yeah.
There's Jim in the studio. I see him behind the glass. Hi, Jim.
Oh, man, he's having a good time over there.
All right, drinking
Coke. With all the scorn, he still stuck to his beliefs, Mark.
Uh-huh.
Even when the American Psychiatric Association removed homosexuality from its list of mental disorders in 1973, replacing it with disco fever.
You're right.
Achoo!
Oh, you need a Kleenex?
Oh, thanks, man.
Man, You might need another one.
God.
You all right?
I'm all right for now, thanks.
Okay. Yeah.
Socarides published at least 11 books throughout his career, including The Overt Homosexual, 1995's Homosexuality, A Freedom Too Far, and the best-selling Okay, My Son is Gay. I Can Explain This. Really. Hear me out. I know.
Who didn't read that?
Yeah. Socarides is survived by 3 divorced wives, 4 children, and lots of unopened closets.
Yeah.
Moving on.
Okay.
George Gerbner, television researcher. George Gerbner, an educator and pioneer researcher into the influence of television violence on viewers' perceptions of reality, has died. But I bet he'll come back next season when we all find out it was just a dream, right?
Yeah, probably.
What do you think?
Yeah, maybe.
There's a good chance of that. I bet that's going to happen.
Come on.
After 3 decades of study, Gerbner concluded America's youth were learning to read by watching television commercials and developing a consumer mentality. Man, you know what? I don't feel fresh. You got any douche?
I do. It's out in my bag.
Oh.
Thanks I mean, no, I don't.
Thanks for rolling with that question.
Yeah. Never say no in improv.
I know.
Go ahead.
In numerous speeches and articles, Gerbner explained how television programming relies on violence to demonstrate, quote, who can get away with what against whom.
Ow! What'd you do that for?
Just checking.
Man.
The 86-year-old Gerbner reportedly died after his grandchildren thought they could wake him up from a nap by lighting a stick of dynamite in his mouth. That was a mess right there. Gerbner requests his remains be subjected to 6 to 8 incidents of violence per hour. And if his children were watching, 20 to 35 incidents per hour.
Numbers.
Numbers are funny. So, how you been doing?
I'm all right. Nice to see you, Mort.
Well, nice to see you, too.
You live out in Burbank, don't you?
I live in the kind of the Echo Park area, too.
Okay.
Along with no, I shouldn't bring that up, should I?
Okay. My ex-wife.
Yeah, your ex-wife. Yeah. So, this has been the Weekly Remembrance. Until next week, this is Mort Mortensen saying, hey, man, how's it going?
That's it. We're changing the sign off.
Yeah.
You're mixing it up?
Yeah. Why not mix it up, man?
All right. Well, why don't you send Jim back in here? All right. Nice to see you.
Hey, Jim.
Yeah, what?
You should come back in here, okay? Okay, I will. Here I am.
Sit down, Jim. There you go.
Hey. Oh, hey. Man.
Yeah, that's great.
How'd that go? How was that, by the way?
It's pretty good. You were out getting a soda. You didn't hear it in the booth?
No, I never listened to the show.
Oh, ever?
Well, I do, you know, the recordings.
So, look, I'm at the Improv the other night, having a good show. By the way, I'll be at the UCB Theater. The UCB Theater on Friday, this Friday.
You're going to Berkeley?
May 5th, UCB Upright Citizens Brigade Theater here on Franklin for an hour. Come on down. I could use some people in the room. I'm going to try and plow through some new things, if that's okay. I need to get out there with the people, and I'd rather not just be four people. This would be a good time to see me because Carlos Mencia cannot show up and hijack my show. So come on down. So anyways, I'm at the Improv. Had a good weekend, by the way. Did some pretty funny stuff. I feel like I'm opening up again, and I'm showing my heart.
Was it a showcase thing, or was it a regular gig?
No, it was just, you know, getting real. Just a regular gig with the folks. There was a showcase for some people on the second show Saturday. There was like 10 people before me, but then I did my set, and it seems like new things are happening. I'm being honest about the amount of time I'm wasting during the day on stage, and I think it's starting to work. But moving on. I talked to this woman, and we're talking about, it was the day of the Spanish National Anthem thing. Now, bottom line, as I said last week, that the reason this happened was this English producer, this guy Kidron, Kidron, I think his last name, I said he's doing it to make some dough, and that has a lot to do with it. But this woman got all choked up, said she just could not listen to it in Spanish, that there seemed to be something so wrong with it. This is a young person, someone I don't really know that well, but she was literally welling up with tears about the idea of the national anthem being sung in Spanish. And I just think I have nothing near that reaction to it. I can't see it as anything but a beneficial thing. I don't find it threatening. And this whole immigration thing, the way the Republicans are using this to unearth, to sort of pry out some sort of racism in people, I think is contemptible, because I have plenty of people that I, especially when you live in California, you work with these people, you work with people who are not necessarily illegal immigrants, but Mexican Americans, and I defy anyone. I think most people are either working with somebody that may not be here legally, but still willing to do the work, have friends that are Mexican Americans, and I just think this whole idea of trying to pry some sort of racial fear or anger out of people as a political device is heinous, and I think it's going to fail. I think it's going to fail because the country is not like that, not with Mexicans. I just don't believe it.
You know, my brother is married to immigrants.
My father is married to a Mexican American and not an immigrant. I think she's probably second or third generation, actually. But that aside, it just seems to me that to use this as a racial wedge is ridiculous. And I have no problem with paying more attention to border security. I don't have any problem with it at all.
I think that woman was probably reacting to the wrong thing. I mean, originally in 1919, when this was translated. In, you know, Star Spangled Banner
yeah.
translated into Spanish.
Yeah.
It was meant as a patriotic thing to instill patriotism in Spanish, I mean, Mexican immigrants.
Well, here's I think that's the way it should be treated now.
And now I think she's taking it in a way like it's an insult towards, 9/11 and all that stuff with, people protesting in the streets with a non-American flag. I think people take that as in, I'm not defending it, but they take it the wrong way.
Yeah, even Condoleezza Rice, who I, certainly don't want to give any credit, said, I've heard the national anthem done in rap versions, country versions, classical versions. I think what we need to focus on is an immigration policy that is comprehensive, that recognizes our laws and recognizes our humanity. End quote. That's Condoleezza Rice. This is a big neocon death cult person, but on that particular point, she happens to be right. We're going to talk to an Army recruiter. What's his name again? Ronnie Randolph, Lieutenant Ronnie Randolph in just a minute, about recruiting tactics, so stay with us.
Now, what's his hidden agenda? Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. I just read an article that about, the Army has really sort of, loosened their standards for recruiting. I read an article right in front of me that, Defense Department game detective at Fort Lewis in Washington State has identified 320 soldiers as gang members. That's just one of the things that they have loosened their standards on. Yes. Tattoos or another one. They've made changes to make the recruitment process easier, and that's using their word. They've eliminated also the requirement for a high school diploma. And not only that, they require right now that potential recruits need only a ninth grade education. The Army has also recently made PlayStation, Xbox video games, and chocolate bars, which they hand out for free. I mean, this is just, to me, it's heinous. And they try to defend these tactics, and I've asked this guy to be on. He's Army recruiter Lieutenant Ronnie Randolph. He's on the phone with us. Thank you for joining us, Lieutenant.
Thank you for having me on the show, Mr. Marin. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you being here, and I got to be honest with you. I mean, what kind of sickness is this? I mean, are you guys, what are you trying to present yourself as, like, cool guys to these kids? You trying to trick them into the Army?
No, Mr. Marin, we're not trying to trick any kids in the Army. See, what we see ourselves as doing is we're trying to provide opportunities to people, to students, to kids who maybe the rest of the world has deemed as not having value. We're trying to find value in them, and we feel that value is in the U.S. military.
But you got to be honest. I mean, you get rid of the idea of a high school diploma. You get rid of they only need a ninth grade education. How much could these kids know? I mean, it sounds to me like you're just exploiting them.
No, it's not. It's not labor exploitation.
Uh-huh.
That's not how we see it at all. We see it as what we're offering is an opportunity for these kids to see wonderful things, to travel the world, like all the things that they're reading in their textbooks. Like, we're actually giving them the opportunity to see these things firsthand. And that's cooler than reading any textbook, to actually see those things.
So you're saying that you're going up to kids and you're saying you're going to try and separate the idea that 2,405 soldiers have been killed in Iraq, and you're trying to say, like, oh, yeah, come on, it's going to be fun.
You know what? Everyone says 2,400 soldiers have died.
Uh-huh.
But what about all the soldiers who haven't died? The numbers are staggering for soldiers who have not died in the U.S. military.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point. You know, I mean, well, what's with the video game? I mean, why don't you just make the age lower and hand out candy, for Christ's sake?
Well, the video game is we're actually very proud of the video game. And what we see ourselves as doing is we're offering something to people. We're offering reality to people. Like, everyone loves to play video games. No, that's not going to stop tomorrow. People are not going to stop playing video games tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
So what we're doing is we're offering a real alternative.
Uh-huh.
Because a lot of people, they'll play, like, games like Metroid or something like that, or they'll pretend to be a wizard.
Uh-huh.
And you can't be a wizard in real life. But what you can do is you can play our game, which is actually showing you reality. And if you enjoy it, then you can actually go and live that lifestyle that you played in the video game.
So what if some kid wants to be a wizard? Are you going to let him be a wizard? Are you lowering your standards that much? Can you say, well, here, you're recruit Mr. Wizard?
No, I'm saying that's the thing. What we're doing is we're offering an alternative to that. I'm saying that to this point in time, there are no wizards. And since there are no wizards, you know, that to me is a bad video game because you put people in this crazy fantasy world where they think that they could be a wizard or they could, you know, be a spaceman or something like that.
Uh-huh.
We're saying, hey, no, here's something that you can do. Play this video game where you can pretend to be a soldier, and guess what? You really can be a soldier. I can make you a soldier. If you sign up today, I can make you a soldier, and you can have great things. You could travel and see the world.
And kill
Everyone
people.
Loves to see the world.
And kill people.
You exactly. That's. I mean, we don't like to put it like that. That you kill people, but that is a byproduct of serving in this military right now. This is a great time to be in the U.S. Army right now.
To kill people.
If you want to kill people, like that's. I'm going to put that out there. That yeah, it's a great time. It's a great. This is what the Army is here for. This is a wonderful time. We have so much
killing,
to offer people at this point in time. It's a great time to join.
A great time to kill people.
To kill people, yes. That's just a byproduct. That's just a byproduct. There are other things that you get to do in the U.S. Army.
All right. Well, we only got a couple more seconds here. I heard that some guys are giving out urine blockers so these recruits can pass drug tests. Is that true?
That is true. There are recruiters that do pass out urine blockers to help some recruits pass drug tests. But I don't want you to make that sound like, oh, the Army is desperate, because we're not desperate for soldiers. That's not a desperation thing. I'm going to tell you a quick little story here.
Well, hold on. You know what? Yeah, just hold on a second. We'll take you over the break, and then we'll finish this. All right? I'm talking to Army Lieutenant Ronnie Randolph, a recruiter.
Live from Burbank, California, ground zero for Rickett, it's the Mark Maron Show. And now, he cannot find Louisiana on a map. Mark Maron.
I can, but I did see that article. But you know what? I'll tell you one thing. You know, if you look at the stats on that article, if you look at what I'm talking about here, we got Army Lieutenant Ronnie Randolph still on the phone here. He's an Army recruiter, but this should help him out. Apparently, Americans between the ages of 18 to 24... are, you know, nearly retarded, which, according to Lieutenant Randolph, would make them perfect for the Army. One-third of respondents couldn't pinpoint Louisiana on a map. 48% weren't able to locate Mississippi. Fewer than 3 in 10 think it's important to know the locations of countries in the news. And just 14% believe speaking another language is a necessary skill. Two-thirds didn't know that the earthquake that killed 70,000 people in October occurred in Pakistan. 6 in 10 could not find a rock on a map in the Middle East. And that doesn't bother you, does it, Lieutenant? I mean, these kids sound perfect for your program. And the less they know, the better. You could just say, well, you're going to this place, and you're going to enjoy it because you get to kill people, right?
Well, exactly. You don't have to know where Iraq is, because we can, why even look at it on a map? I can put you on a plane there tomorrow.
Do you know where it is?
I know it's in the Middle East.
Oh, no, man. All right, so what you're going to... This is very disturbing, dude. So, I'm sorry, Lieutenant. Can you tell me the story you're going to tell me so we can get on with this thing?
Sure. You were sort of... I got the impression that you were insinuating that the Army was desperate.
Wait, you're giving out candy bars and video games.
We see those as perks, all right? We give out candy bars. They don't give out candy bars. If you work at the bank, you don't get free candy. We give out free candy bars. If you're a soldier and you're wounded in battle, you actually get free candy bars. That's something that we do.
What about health coverage and proper health care after? We just keep giving them more candy bars? Like, I need pain medicine. Well, you have another candy bar.
Candy is a very good thing, and candy is a good medicine. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Patch Adams, but sometimes humor and candy and treats like that can do a lot more than modern medicine or pain relievers or things of that nature.
Sorry you lost your leg, Private. Have a candy bar. And hey, you want to look at my clown nose? Is that the thing you're saying?
If that's what helps patients, I know that I recently twisted an ankle, and sometimes what helped me not think about it was just if I was laughing with some friends while we were out, just out on routine missions and doing drills. Like, that to me was more exciting and helped me forget about the pain in my ankle than if I had, worried about getting a splint or taking ibuprofen or something like that.
Right, that's very, maybe you should have got a candy bar.
I did get candy bars.
All right.
The candy bars I want. I have a surplus of candy bars.
I bet you do, because, you're not getting any takers. You guys are hurting. You're desperate. You are desperate. So tell me this story.
No, we're not desperate.
All
and
right.
Here's why we're not desperate. I'm going to tell you a story. In World War II, this is real.
Uh-huh.
In World War II, Adolf Hitler's nephew, William Hitler, he was called Willie Patrick Hitler, could not get into the Nazi army. All right?
Okay.
He could not get into the Nazi army.
You would think he could have with those connections.
You would think. And
yeah.
He tried, but could not get into the Nazi army.
Uh-huh.
But during World War II, he was allowed into the U.S. Navy. Could not get into the Nazi Army,
Come
but allowed
on.
Into the U.S. Navy.
Come on. You're pulling my leg.
This is real. You can look it up on the Internet. There are books about it. Willie
All
Hitler
right.
was in the U.S. Navy after
right.
being rejected by the Nazi Army.
So you're saying you're not desperate. You're not that desperate. You'll take a ninth grader that doesn't know where Iraq is. You'll take gang members. You'll take people with tattoos. You got your guys handing out urine blockers so they can get through recruitment, even if they have drugs in their system. But you won't take the nephew of a fascist dictator. So that makes you good?
Exactly. We will not take Hitler's. We will not take any of Hitler's family.
All right. Well, you know, I got to go, man. This has been very enlightening, Lieutenant Ronnie Randolph. I appreciate your time. I think you have a horrendous job, and I'm not sure. I'm pretty damn sure, actually, that I don't like your tactics. But I appreciate your time on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. And if you ever want to come down to the recruiting station, we have some candy bars, and we could talk to you. Maybe I mean, we have a lot of opportunities that we could talk to you about.
I'm 42 years old. Are you that desperate?
I'm just saying there are a lot of things that a man like you can still do in the U.S. military.
Okay, well, thank you. I'll certainly consider that, Army Lieutenant Ronnie Randolph. You have a good day.
Thank you, Mr. Marin. You do the same.
Okay, bye. Wow, what the hell was that? I had no idea what I was getting into.
That's just not right.
All right, let's do this. Look, since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that listeners know what's going on in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world, so here now is our very own Planet Bush Bureau Chief, Lawton Smalls. Hello, Lawton.
Hello, Mark. God's got out his dipstick, and you're about a quart low on Jesus.
All right.
At least a quart low.
Okay, Lawton. All right. Now, look, even you have to admit that gas prices have gotten out of hand, my friend.
Yes, indeed, Mark.
Uh-huh.
Gas prices are still pretty low.
But
I'm optimistic.
Low? What are you talking about? It's like almost $4 a gallon out here.
I know. Gas is practically free. I don't know how those old boys at the oil companies are going to make it this year. I really don't. We should give them some more tax cuts.
Now, wait a
That
minute.
Would be the Christian thing
wait
to do.
Wait a minute. Lawton,
tax cuts.
I don't know how we're going to make it this year. Gas prices are disgusting. They're obscene. We should demand that the oil companies give some of those profits back, Lawton.
Okay, let me paint you a picture.
Uh-huh.
What if I came into your studio and said, "Hey, Mark, heck of a job on the radio this week, buddy. Fantastic. In fact, you were so good, I think you should give back 20% of your earnings." Well, no thank you, Mr. Karl Marx.
Uh-huh.
You lip floppers just hate it when anybody tries to scrape together a dollar or two.
Whoa, wait a minute. I hate the greed and the gouging and the contempt for the regular people that comes from oil companies, Lawton.
Hey, stop that. That is hate speech against a persecuted minority.
What minority?
Oil millionaires.
Oh, boy.
They're They're people too, you know.
Uh-huh.
Cut them, and they bleed.
Mm.
And they have children.
Mm-hmm.
They may be listening to your ugly, hate-filled slurs right now.
Mm.
But I guess some groups aren't entitled to your all-encompassing liberal love. Well, that's a civil rights violation, hotshot. See you in court. We shall overcome. Hater?
Oh, now, you stop that.
Hater.
You stop it. Your boy Bush is worried about getting impeached,
hater.
So his oil crony friends are trying to stick it to us as much as they can before he's thrown out of office, all right? It's a disaster, one.
It's a plan, okay? President George W. two-terms mandate Bush is just taking a page out of President Ronald W. two-terms mandate Reagan's book,
uh-huh.
Okay?
Yeah.
The more profits the oil fellas make, the more money trickles down to the rest of the economy for, you know, stuff like art galleries and skate parks and promise keeper rallies. Hey, no one gives back to regular folks like big oil.
Oh,
no one.
Mm.
They are the Dale Earnhardt Jr. of tricklers down.
Well, wait a minute. So you're saying
good tricklers.
That high oil prices are a good thing.
Bingo, Mark.
Oh, boy.
Very simple.
Mm-hmm.
Pay more at the pump now. Get more later. All right?
Mm.
Even you might get a taste of their generosity someday, Mr. Khrushchev. In fact, I want to hear you say, thank you, Exxon, right now on the air. Go ahead, say it.
All right, I will.
Say it.
All right, wait. Thank you, Exxon, for ruining our economy.
Oh.
Thank you, Exxon, for endangering millions of jobs.
Oh.
Thank you, Exxon.
Wait a minute. Jobs?
Uh-huh.
Hey, what about the fellas who changed the numbers on the gas station signs? I think they need work, too. I don't hear a bleeding heart love song about them and their plight, now do I?
Now listen to me, buddy. Bush was bought and paid for by these oil companies, and now he's just paying them back. And you know it. And you know who loses. You do, Lawton. You lose, and you know it, too. You can't escape this. You have to drive, too, my friend. I know you do. Yeah, that's right. Find the heart. Find your heart.
Mark, I pulled up to the pump the other day.
Uh-huh.
In my white Cadillac Escalade with the new rims.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
I said to the kid working there, fill it up.
Uh-huh.
And afterwards he said, okay, that'll be $65.
Yeah.
$65. I have no idea.
Yeah.
I'm so allergic in my wallet.
Yeah.
I didn't have enough money to pay for it.
Uh-huh.
So the owner made me stay there and pump gas for 3 hours.
3 hours.
3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
People yelled at me for being too slow.
Mm.
They called me an a-hole. I had to clean dead bugs off the windshield, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
Dead bugs.
All right, okay. All right. Settle down. Settle down, Rodden, please. Just come on. All right. We know the gas prices are horrible.
What am I putting in my gas tank, Mark? Diamonds?
Uh-huh.
Beluga freaking caviar?
All right.
I might as well throw a Rolex in my tank.
I know.
I'm not using it.
It's hard on everybody, Lawton. It's hard on everybody. Just breathe, okay? Please. I don't want to get off. You okay? Oh, boy. Yeah.
You know, I think $5 a gallon's really what we should be shooting for,
uh-huh,
here.
Yeah.
Then those oil boys, they can really make some headway with five. I think that's
good. Stop it. All right, Lawton. Goodbye.
You know, God loves you.
Mm-hmm.
Deal with it. Hey, what about $6?
Goodbye, Lawton.
$6.50.
Goodbye.
$6.50.
All right. So that's where he's at with that. That's Lawton Smalls. But look, after the break here, we've got an interesting guest, Joseph Masco. He's the author of Nuclear Borderlands, The Manhattan Project, and Post-Cold War New Mexico. He can maybe give us some insight into the repercussions of nuclear testing. They are testing bunker busters at the beginning of June at the Nevada test site. Stay with us.
And now he's boosting organ donations. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Wow, what a day it's been so far. Given the reality, folks, that the neocon death cult might actually be preparing to use nuclear weapons against Iran, and they are planning tests of the bunker-busting nukes at the Nevada test site that could blast a cloud of radioactive dust into the atmosphere, It is the first test at that site in years. It is once again important to open the dialogue about the repercussions of these tests over the long term and the repercussions of unleashing the violence onto the world in the short term. Joseph Mosco has written a book about my home state called The Nuclear Borderlands, The Manhattan Project in Post-Cold War New Mexico. He's with us now. He's an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Chicago. Welcome to the show, Joseph Mosco.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Okay. Well, I grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Bomb science was all around me. I went to the Atomic Museum that you have in your book there when I was a kid. I went to White Sands. It was never brought to my attention that it was unsafe. What is my state, just a glowing from outer space?
Well, it is the center of the U.S. Nuclear economy and has been for quite some time. So it's the one state in the country that has pretty much the entire nuclear cycle, from uranium mining through weapons design to nuclear waste storage.
All of them dangerous. I just saw a documentary about the Navajo uranium miners, and that just destroyed three generations of the Navajo Nation with cancer.
Yeah, very difficult story.
Yeah.
And the linkage between indigenous politics issues and nuclear science and nuclear projects is one of the deep stories of the Cold War in the U.S.
Now, your focus in the book is post-Cold War New Mexico. How did the Manhattan Project affect that state, like, say, culturally?
Yeah, well, the question that I was really interested in the book was looking at how the end of the Cold War had affected security debates in New Mexico. And as I started to research that, both within the weapons laboratories and also in communities who live around them, it became very clear that it was a story that stretched back to the real origins of the Manhattan Project in 1943. And that much of what was being learned and that was becoming part of the public debate in New Mexico in the 1990s really was a kind of reflection on 40 years of weapon science and national security projects in the region that were kind of becoming public for the first time.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the local economies, certainly you go down to White Sands, I mean, that as in terms of a tourist attraction, same with Los Alamos and same with the Atomic Museum, Kirkland Air Force Base, that became part of the state economy just in terms of people would come to see these atomic landmarks.
Oh, that's right, yeah, and increasingly so in the last decade. There's a kind of new form of atomic tourism that connects a series of museums across the country, as well as the test site in New Mexico, which is open a couple days a year. And it's part of kind of military tourism, but I think it also reveals a bigger set of cultural concerns with just trying to recover memory and history on these issues, because even for people who have lived through the last the development of the nuclear security state, there was very, very few moments where the kind of nature of these projects and the details of state planning was really made public.
And yeah, because they were too busy. Weren't they so intent on doing the research and making these tests occur that to even start talking about the liabilities, both on the health of the people in the state or in the community, would be something they wouldn't want to get out.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the arms race was real, and for the people that were within the weapons labs, the kind of press to produce new technology and to push the arms race further into, you know, new generations of weapons and delivery systems was really quite profound. And in many cases, the kind of health effects took a backseat to those concerns. And the bigger issue is, of course, the kind of accumulated legacy of nuclear waste and contaminated sites, which ends up being a huge story in the U.S. There's about 110 sites that the Department of Energy recognizes will never really be effectively remediated, that the U.S. will be watching, you know, in perpetuity for their risk to public health.
Well, you know, and also these new ways of mining uranium could pollute aquifers forever. And now, you know, this, if we could, in the last couple minutes here, talk about the reality that they are going to be testing new technologies, these bunker-busting technologies. They are going to do that in Nevada. It is going to create an aerial event. Now, what do we look for when something like this happens? What are the repercussions of above-ground testing? Even though they say it's underground, it's going to produce a mushroom cloud.
Yeah, what they're going to be doing is exploding a very large conventional explosive, something in the neighborhood of 700 tons. The Hiroshima bomb was about 15 kilotons, so about 20 times larger than that. And what this is, evidently, by all reports, is an effort to model what the shock effects would be on a buried structure of large-scale explosions. And so the thought is that there's an effort here to model the kind of explosives that would be necessary to destroy deeply buried targets. And this has a long history in the U.S. It goes back at least to the first Gulf War in terms of the understanding that Saddam Hussein, for instance, during that conflict hid in underground bunkers. And so there has been one side of the U.S. Military planning and nuclear community that has been interested in developing what's a very small nuclear explosive, but very focused and something that could be used to hit underground targets.
All right, but the bottom line is that there's really no safe nuclear weapon.
Oh, no, no, no.
All right.
And in fact, the atmospheric fallout from this would be quite damaging, and all the studies suggest that there's even for the kind of utility factor that's argued for in terms of military planning, this would be quite destructive and would have wide-ranging atmospheric effects, and of course would break all sorts of prohibitions on the use of nuclear materials. It would have quite damaging international consequences.
Well, thank you for your time, Joseph Masco. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure to be with you.
Okay, take care. We'll be back.
Now get off his mushroom cloud, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. You know, when I do interviews, this book that Joseph Masco wrote that I have here, The Nuclear Borderlands, it's a pretty specific book. But I think that from all indications, I went to the website of the concerned scientists that Randy Rhodes had been talking about all week, and they have a cartoon to illustrate what those tests are going to look like. I guess I could put a link up on my site. I believe I will. It's the Union of Concerned Scientists, why do I open my mouth if I don't know what the hell I'm going to say? I will put a link to it. I will also put a link to the UCB Theater, where I will be on Friday night at 8 o'clock, Upright Citizens Brigade Theater here in Los Angeles. Come on out. It'll be intimate. It'll be nice. We'll talk. We'll try to create some improvisational funny right there in front of you. For my first trick, I will make you all understand me. That is the focus of that evening. And
are you going to make cupcakes and stuff?
I don't know. Right now we're going to talk to my butter. Yeah, maybe I can make some cupcakes. I've working on those Johnny cakes, and it's not a gay thing. I was inspired by The Sopranos to learn how to make Johnny cakes because I never had them before, and I'm a big cornbread fan.
Speaking of a cupcake.
Yes, Jim.
Here's Jack Boulware. Huh?
Talking about a cupcake. Yeah. Our guest has been a close friend of mine for years. He was the publisher of the now defunct seminal freak show Out There magazine, The Nose. He spent time with Satan. He's hung with the inventor of the window pane delivery system for LSD. He's chased wild pigs through the hills of Northern California, and he's pursued and caught the elusive wahoo fish off the coast of New Orleans. Jack Boulware has traveled the far reaches of the world chasing down the most marginal travel stories available. His work has appeared in Playboy, New York Times Magazine, Wired, Maxim, Salon. He's here now to talk about something he's got coming out in Southwest Magazine. If you fly Southwest, a very good airline, I might add. You can read his work coming up. When is this coming out, Jack?
It comes out in July, I think.
So this is Pirates, Jack. We're going to talk about Pirates.
Pirates.
How the hell did that happen? Where does the incentive for that? Who pitched that story? Was that your idea?
They actually came to me because I'd written about pirates before.
You have written about pirates.
Yeah, a couple years ago they found the wreck of Blackbeard, the pirate ship, off the coast of the Carolinas.
Uh-huh.
It had been missing for 300 years, and they came upon it by accident, so they've been hauling stuff up. And I wrote that story about Blackbeard, so these guys saw that and said, hey, why don't you do an overview of pirate history?
So they said, Jack's a pirate guy. Get Jack for this.
He's a pirate guy. He understands, I don't know, piracy on the high seas. I don't know.
I've hung out with pirates before back in the old days in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I think the word pirate can mean a lot of different things.
Yeah.
It can mean everything from, you know, hijacking a ship at sea to, you know, a skateboard punk who's got a lot of attitude. He's a pirate.
Yeah, or just a guy that came with the stuff.
Yeah, he's the pirate.
Those are the pirates with the booty. So so how'd you approach this pirate story? Who'd you talk to?
I talked to this guy, Pat Crochet. He's a a rich guy. He just opened a pirate museum in Key West. It's the largest collection of pirate memorabilia in the world. He's just one of those weird entrepreneurial guys. He's a motivational speaker. He's got books on, you know, how to make a killing in business.
Does he open his? Does he go, "Arrgh, mateys, you want to learn how to do business?"
No, it's kind of like talking to Tony Robbins. You know?
Oh, really?
He's just pumped about everything. Pumped about pirates and his new rum restaurant. He's pumped. He used to own the Philadelphia 76ers too, so he's got this. You know, he's just a big jock business guy, but he loves pirates. He and his wife dress up like pirates. I mean,
they do?
Yeah, they do. They have like pirate days, you know, and everybody dresses up like a pirate. Whatever.
Wait. Now he has instituted his own pirate days. That just the restaurants he owns, or is he trying to? Does he do that with all of Key West? Does he put it upon the community? Say it's pirate day. I own this town.
Well, they have a big pirate festival in I think it's Tampa every year.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, Florida is just kind of a pirate crazy in general.
So what characterized the pirates?
Well, these were the first pirate. It goes way back to, you know, biblical times, but organized piracy on the high seas. What we think of, you know, guys running around the Caribbean with you know, black Jolly Roger flags and everything.
The wooden leg and a eye patch.
Yeah. That's just, you know, nobody ever walked a plank. I mean,
really?
There's a lot of myths that came up. Earl Flynn, I think, gave us an idea of what pirates should be. You know, open chest, you know, sword play on the deck kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
But in fact, these guys, they were often stolen and hijacked against their will and shoved out on a boat. And the leaders of the pirate gangs were originally hired by the British government to hijack Spanish ships on the high seas because the British government was fighting a war with Spain and didn't have any money, didn't have any ships. So they actually paid guys to go out and, you know, bring us back whatever you take, and you get a cut of it, and we'll the rest will go to the queen.
So this is sort of like Al-Qaeda almost. They took these unsavory characters and says, we'll pay you to do this, and then after they were done with them, they became the business themselves.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of them said, well, why are we giving any money to the queen? You know, screw it.
Yeah.
Let's just do it ourselves. So actually, you know, that's kind of how the modern golden age of piracy started.
And how were they organized? What was the system? Were they good guys to each other? I mean, there's a lot of stories about you know, the gay pirates and
rum and sodomy. Yeah, totally. Well, they didn't allow women on board, so you know, take that as you will.
Yeah.
And these guys they had very low lifespan. I mean, if they weren't killed in a battle, they were usually caught eventually and hung or decapitated. Sometimes these guys, they would be encased in their corpse. You know, if they weren't beheaded, they would be encased and hung up on a stick outside a harbor. So anyone who entered the harbor, say, of London, would look and see, oh, there's a body sticking up, you know, on the shoreline. That'd be sort of like a little scarecrow to other people to, you know, not try piracy.
To other pirates. I think Burroughs wrote, I think Cities of the Red Night, I can't remember which one is all about buggering pirates.
Yeah,
I can't remember.
Well, of course, Burroughs' version of piracy would be 98% buggering.
And maybe some outer space action.
there would be one scene with a very long scrotum. But
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, with a black flag and the skull bones on it. So, and that would be dangling off the top of the ship.
Yeah, you won't see that in the Johnny Depp movie.
Oh, you won't see that. No, well, that's what I read your article. It's like, what's interesting is that obviously they don't look like Johnny Depp, but it, you know, all the ride when you go on that rides Pirates of the Caribbean and these creepy kind of half rotting pirates, that was sort of true to history.
Yeah, you know, there was if they didn't get killed or hung,
yeah,
they died at sea, usually, you know, from scurvy or syphilis. I mean, it would affect their bodies. Their gums would start bleeding. You know, they would have blood coming out of every orifice. It wasn't pretty.
I mean,
a lot of these guys just succumbed. You know, if you were a pirate and you were 35, you were an old man.
It's interesting. I wish that Walt Disney would have been a little more elaborate on those themes. You know, on the Pirates of the Caribbean, you could sort of see the syphilitic pirate and the scurvy pirate, just blood coming out of their orifices. That's real scary.
It would be great if it did shoot over people on the little boat.
Oh.
I mean, that would be, you know.
What's that, Jim?
That's probably why they started saying, "Arg."
Yeah.
Oh man, arg, matey.
Yeah, they got to finish that. Arg, it hurts when I pee.
Was there any of that? Did they really say arg, matey? Did they have a hook and a parrot?
Not that I know of. I mean, that came later when people fictionalized the world of pirates. They wrote books about them, and of course, those books were made into the early movies. Yeah, I didn't come across anybody with a hook or a parrot or anything. There was a pirate off the coast of Florida named Black Caesar. He was an African king. And I thought, Black Caesar, wasn't that like a Fred Williamson movie, Blaxploitation?
Yeah, it should have been. I would like to see a movie about a black pirate. So what about, where'd they hang out? I mean, because I never get a sense. Was this an American phenomenon? Or?
They came to American shores to kind of chill out and party. They really sort of hung out in the Caribbean. There was an island right near Dominican Republic called Tortuga.
Uh-huh.
That was kind of like a ground zero for pirates. And they also hung out at this place, Port Royal, which is in Jamaica. It's an ancient town on the coast in Jamaica. And those were kind of where they came in and out of. But they were on the seas for months at a time. So
New Orleans, too, right?
And New Orleans, there was a very famous pirate there named Jean Lafitte.
Mm-hmm.
We all know the name. But the fact was, he worked out of the bayou, and he had all these crazy bayou guys working for him. And he had about 50 ships, and he cruised the Gulf of Mexico. He even set up his own colony, his own utopian pirate community in Texas near Galveston.
Really?
Yeah, there was 1,000 people living in this little town that he built. I mean, he was really a visionary, you know?
I had no idea. So, that's amazing. That's a political visionary. He created a pirate utopia.
Yeah, and what's the great thing about the pirates is that there's so much legend built up over them that you could throw a dart at the southeastern United States and somebody has a story. Oh, yeah, there's pirate treasure here.
Oh, really?
They're looking for it. They found the ribs of a ship in the forest somewhere, and, they're calling the cops, and, hey, I think there's pirates here, There's at least 3 skulls that are supposed to be of Blackbeard's skull. At least 3 different ones floating around, everyone's saying.
Was there?
It's the official Blackbeard skull,
It's sort of like Jesus relics.
Yeah, they are. I mean, when you think about it, though, these guys were like, thieves and thugs and rapists and murderers, and everyone thinks of them today as, they're just fun.
Yeah.
Well, they have a sense of fun about them, and, they did work for themselves, and they were,
Well, some people think all those things are fun. I mean, there's no denying that. I mean, if you look at S. Clay Wilson's work, I mean, I think he probably captured it better than anybody.
Oh, yeah. I think if pirates were really around today, they'd watch pirate movies.
Yeah. Well, what the hell was I just going to say? There are still pirates, aren't they? But I guess it's not as glamorous as it once be. But I know the Coast Guard still keeps an eye out for them.
Yeah, a lot of them are, they try to attack a cruise ship once in a while, or there's a body of water in between Malaysia and Indonesia called the Malacca Strait.
Mm-hmm.
That's where much of the world's shipping actually comes through that strait. So a lot of the targets are basically cargo ships.
All right,
and there's there's the Southeastern Asian gangs of pirates.
Oh, I remember what I was going to ask you. Did they ever find a significant pirate booty that this myth has always been based on? Have they found pirate treasures?
They have actually found pirate treasures. One of the most famous ones is off the coast of Key West. There were, I think, 11 or 12 ships that were caught in a hurricane, and they all went down. And this one guy, God bless him, he's dead now, Mel Fisher was his name. And Mel was obsessed with pirates, and he spent 16 years looking for this very famous wreck off the coast of Key West. And he finally found it, and they're hauling up millions and millions of dollars in gold and silver. They're still hauling it up. So much that he died, his family is continuing it, and they've built a museum, and they stuff a bunch of the stuff in the museum, and you can go check it out.
Did they build it out of gold?
They should have melted it down. No, it's actually out of platinum.
All right. The high-end stuff. Well, Jack, thanks, man. So I put a link to your site, jackbulware.com,
cool.
On markmaron.com, and you can read the pirate story and a lot of other stuff. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, take it easy.
All right, Jack. That was Jack Bulware. Go to jackbulware.com, go to markmaron.com, link yourself to it.
Pirate expert, I think, Jack Bulwark.
Well, now he is. I'm sure that'll get some, a lot of people are pirate experts. We'll be back with the short order news and some closing thoughts.
Depressed because you haven't heard anything funny yet? Well, me too. Well, all that's about to change, maybe, because Mark Maron's short order news is coming up next.
Now back to the Mark Maron Show. Mark?
Yes, sir.
Before we go on, I'd like to share with you a quote from George Germner, the television researcher that we spoke of earlier. It's very interesting. He wrote this like in 1981. He said, "The most general and prevalent association with television viewing is a heightened sense of living in a mean world of violence and danger. fearful people are more dependent, more easily manipulated and controlled, more susceptible to deceptively simple, strong, tough measures and hard-line postures. They may even accept and even welcome repression if it promises to relieve their insecurities. This is the deeper problem of violence laid in television. Now, that, I don't think anything applies better to the techniques of the Bush administration.
And propaganda, and just keeping people watching in general, because there's all that criticism about how violence is, and obviously his point is true, it's intentional to keep people in their house feeling placated.
Afraid and placated.
That is profound, because that's the way this medium is used, and that's, I think, is also what's going on with the way Rove runs his political strategy, just by virtue of how even just the immigration issue is being handled in some ways to generate a certain amount of fear and contempt for people that are here in this country either illegally or just here, you know, working. I know a lot of people are threatened by this in a very personal way in terms of their own work situation, but I think that race baiting and fear is part of this. And just by virtue of the fact that I read something that was Condoleezza Rice dismissing the idea about the issue of the national anthem, I still think that this political issue is being both. There are two different sides being taken by both progressives and by the right, and I think that the right is doing that just so it will enable Republican candidates to run as jingoistic and racist a campaign as they are enabled to within their communities, if their communities go in for that, as well as the ones that can run on something else. I think it's a broad issue that has a lot of different approaches to it. The other thing I thought that was kind of interesting in terms of what I talked about earlier, in that there are gangs, that these gang members who are joining the military. And from one count at one base, a guy said there have been 320 soldiers that he has identified as gang members, and they're tagging Iraq with American gangs. And the real concern that, but this is interesting because this is exactly what's going on in Iraq. On the other side, the way that Iraq has now become a terrorist training ground to the point where terrorists or aspiring terrorists come from around the planet to, you know, use our soldiers as target practice, the concern of the military in terms of gang members in the military is that they're going to go back to the urban communities they come from with the skills that they learned in Iraq and take that to the streets of urban America. So there's a fear that they need these guys there because they're probably pretty tough guys willing to do some, you know, pretty serious damage as military soldiers. But the idea that they are going to come back trained with the strategies and the techniques of warfare that they learned in the Army and apply that to the urban streets of America is a pretty interesting idea, isn't it?
Man, oh man. Well, you know, I live in constant fear anyway, so it's all right with me.
I don't, you know, I think people are generally good, and I am not as frightened as I think I am a lot of times. I am afraid of people, but I generally will walk through that fear. I do think the best of people, and in terms of even the most frightening, I've hung out with some pretty frightening guys in my life.
Woo!
But I find even they, if you talk to them like people, will become people for that moment anyways.
And then when you turn your back, boom!
Well, yeah, but hopefully it's not you. A lot happened in the news today, and I don't want you to be caught off guard or uninformed, so we here at the Mark Maron Show have this little service to provide you. Here tonight is now the Mark Maron Show Short Order News. Iran threatened today to attack Israel in response to any, quote, evil act by the United States. The Iranians also said that they do not want to build a nuclear bomb, but if the U.S. attacks them, they'll be forced to throw one together from whatever materials happen to be lying around. That may be funny, but that's true. And you know that by outing Valerie Plame, Karl Rove and company lessened the security of the ports from Iran, from any sort of weapons, because she was on that beat. Weapons of mass destruction in Iran.
That guy knows how to work it.
A diner at TGI Fridays found a piece of human flesh on his hamburger shortly after a restaurant worker accidentally cut his finger. And that's the story behind the new TGI Fridays Dahmer Burger. Under trial for fraud and conspiracy, former Enron CEO Ken Lay testified how he sold $70 million in Enron shares back to the company to pay for personal luxuries. All this could have been avoided with little changes, like get a medium-sized yacht instead of a super-sized yacht, eat with a jeweled shrimp fork, not a jewel-encrusted shrimp fork, light your cigar with a $50 bill instead of a $100 bill. It's not too late, Ken. Come on, make some changes. Lay, the son of a Baptist preacher who grew up in poverty, will hopefully be revisiting his roots very soon. And that's the Mark Maron Show Short Order News for today. Tomorrow, we've got quite a show, Jim. Do you know Ed Driscoll?
Ed Driscoll. You know, it sounds familiar, but I don't think I ever met
him. Not seen Ed Driscoll in a long time. Was a very funny stand-up way back when, you know, back in the days when he was a hardcore boozer. Inspired a lot of people. A lot of people like Dana Gould. He wrote for Dennis Miller. He's written comedy for everybody. He's got a book out that is put out by Hazleton. By the Hazleton Press, which should tell you something, which basically means it is a sanctioned recovery book. And if it's Ed Driscoll, it's got to be tremendously funny. I'm looking forward to talking to him. Harry Shearer is going to be on the phone with us, and he's got his own radio show, so he's not easy to get on the phone. And he's, plugging a new CD and DVD that he has out. Tim Grieve from Salon.com, the political correspondent over there, is going to do the news crunch with us tomorrow. See if he can shed some light on some recent unfoldings in the political spectrum, my
news
friend.
News crunch. Crunch.
The crunch. I think we haven't really branded that. The crunch.
Well, that's it, man.
Will you do that? Can we lay that down?
News crunch.
Good. That'll be good. Good night, sheeple. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thing.
Oh, I got to go to yoga.
Whatever. Yeah.